This is Michael Cowan, and welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation.
You are the leader in the courtroom, and you want the jury to be looking to you for the answers.
When you figure out your theory, never deviate.
You want the facts to be consistent, complete, and credible.
The defense has no problem running out the clock. Delay is the friend of the defense.
It's tough to grow a firm by trying to hold on and micromanage.
You've got to front load a simple structure for jurors to be able to hold on to.
What types of creative things can we do as lawyers, even though we don't have a trial setting?
Whatever you've got to do to make it real, you've got to do to make it real. But the person who needs convincing is you.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation. Your source to win bigger verdicts, get more cases, and manage your law firm. And now, here's your host, noteworthy author, sought-after speaker, and renowned trial lawyer, Michael Cowan.
We're going to start a new feature on this podcast. It's Ask Michael and Mallory Anything. If you have anything you'd like to ask either Mallory or me, we're going to start doing an episode every couple months where we're going to answer your questions. So just send them in to me at michael@cowanlaw.com, and Mallory and I will answer them. Anything from, you know, legal strategy, marketing management, anything else in life you want to talk about, we'll be glad to talk about it with you. Again, ask Michael and Mallory anything. Just send us an email. We'll be glad to answer your questions. Welcome to today's Trial Lawyer Nation. This is our last episode for the year 2025. And I am joined by my fabulous partner, Sonia Rodriguez, and we're going to talk about what are the lessons we learned in 2025. Sonia, how are you doing?
I'm great, Michael. How are you?
I'm actually doing all right. Just came out of a 2.5 week trial and went right from there, got a verdict one day, and then went and did a mediation on a double fatality case the next. So I'm a little drained. I'm ready for a little end of the year rest and respite, but it's been a great year. We had a nice result at the trial. And so, you know, I'm ready to, you know, learn our lessons from 2025 and then start working on making 26 an even better year.
It doesn't hurt that it's gorgeous weather in San Antonio, nice and warm and cozy. And
yeah,
people are wearing shorts every other day.
So let's talk about it then. Sonia, what are some big things that you learned in 2025?
So to get ready for our talk today, I went back and looked at my docket and the cases that we resolved this year. And, you know, some were higher than I had anticipated. As you know, what we do at our office is we do case valuation. So, you know, with all of my cases, I go in knowing what I suspect the value of the case is going to be for settlement and trial. You know, some cases settled for more than I had anticipated, and some cases settled for less than I had anticipated. But I think across the board, I feel comfortable now looking back that every single one of those cases, I maximized the value. But the ultimate result was informed by peer review. So I think having our case valuations every Tuesday has helped me kind of recalibrate my own thinking. Cause I think sometimes if you've been practicing too long, like I've been practicing, you know, over 25 years now, it's easy to get into this mindset that, you know, what a case is worth and you know what it should settle for. But I found it helpful to hear from you and Mallory and the other lawyers in the office about, you know, maybe I was overthinking it or overshooting it on some cases or overworking a case. And the same is true also for cases that I had maybe gotten too close to. You know the facts so intimately that you assume the whole universe is going to see the warts in the case. And, you know, there were cases that you and the other lawyers in the firm thought, you know, maybe some of the problems I thought I had in the case weren't as bad as I thought they were.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is so important. You know, we have a real obligation to our clients to properly value their cases. So one, of course, you never want to undersell a client. You never want to settle a case for too little money. But there's also a danger of being unrealistically optimistic on your evaluation, because to put a client through a trial, rack up all those expenses, and then have them get much, much less than they would have had they settled is also not good for the client. And so I think having that, you know, we do that within our firm. Frankly, on our biggest cases, I also do that informally with friends of mine that have had similar really big cases. And so I would encourage, you know, those listeners who are not in a firm, they're solos, or you just have like one or two lawyers at your firm. I mean, get a network of other plaintiff lawyers. And I think it's really important to try to include in your network lawyers that have been there. Because, you know, if you're just starting out and all your friends are just starting out, frankly, none of y'all know what the case is worth yet. you know what you want it to be worth. But, you know, find people that you trust that will tell you what it is. That will sit down. You can have a, you know, have a beer, have a cup of coffee, have lunch, whatever it is, and be each other's sounding boards. It makes a huge difference. The other thing we've done more in the last year, in 2025, than we've ever done before is having both the big data and what they call medium data, where, you know, 75 to 400 people look at a case to get a better idea of what it's worth. And I will tell you, we've had a few cases that either because it was an atypical injury, or it just, we knew it was worth a lot, but we didn't know exactly how much. I found that big data was really helpful. I know there's one case that we resolved for multiple eight figures that, you know, to tell the clients to hold out without having that big data, you know, to life-changing money, knowing that you're very likely to get even more. And then being able to tell a mediator, like, here's the study, we've done the work. And we know this case is worth X, and that X is a lot more than what they want to pay today. And so they're either going to pay X or we're going to go try it. It made it a lot easier. I think I would have had a lot more self-doubt had I not done that, you know, worked with the Campbells and with Jessica Brilow to get the big data evaluation. And even like some of the other cases where, you know, it doesn't justify that $35,000 expense, but you can do what they call the FRED study and at least run it by 75 people. And it gives you just a much better idea what a case is worth.
Well, we did that too in the trial that we had in Travis County. We focus grouped that case twice. And, you know, I keep going back to the fact that when I look at my notes of what the jurors, our pretend jurors, were valuing the case, they were pretty darn close to what and now, of course, those are people from that county. And we had two different focus groups. So, I mean, after the second focus group, the numbers kept coming back around the same thing.
Yeah.
Kind of. It really does help inform value.
It really does, but not all cases, you know, can bear that cost. So, again, your idea of what we did at the firm and what I think other people have, just roundtabling it. That's what insurance companies do. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, talk to your peers and get a better idea of what the case is worth. And that way, you know, your client gets the best possible advice. And then, if you're going to do that, you know, you're going to ask other people to help you value your cases, then you need to help them value their cases. It's got to be a two-way street.
Right. The funny thing is, too, I think sometimes people think that they might lack the expertise to be able to value a case, but it's really just common sense. I mean, if you're given a fair evaluation of the facts of the case, the good things, the bad things, the things that are really bugging you about a case, and you pitch it to your neighbor, your dad, or your sister-in-law, the things that are going to resonate to them or percolate to the top are probably going to be the same things that bother a jury.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you get good ideas on big issues that way. But to get true value, I think you either need to have experienced practitioners, or you need to get like a bigger sample size. Because, you know, if I talk to my mom, I love my mom, but none of my cases would be worth very much. Whereas if I talk to my dad, I'd be retiring on every case.
I want your dad on my jury.
Yeah, no, you'd want my dad on my jury. And I love my mother, and I've said this before in jury selection, I would not want my mother on my jury. I love her dearly. But she would not give a lot of money in a case.
Michael, what did you learn this year?
Well, I got a list of six things, and I'm just going to say the six, and then we can go back and forth between your stuff and my stuff. One is that AI is useful but imperfect. Two is just remembering the importance of taking care of myself at trial, because I've tried three cases. I did a really good job of it one time and not so good of a job the other time, and the way I felt and the way I performed, I think, was affected. Three, I think there's some major changes happening in our industry, and I want to go into more detail about that. Four, you know, the importance of clarity when you're working with teams and being ultra clear at the expense of, you know, not wanting to be too gentle. I always want to be gentle. I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but when you're not really clear with people, it's hard to get getting the message across. The importance of consistency, and then finally, what I want to end with is, this is a really good time to try cases. especially in conservative jurisdictions. I mean, our firm tried four cases this year. We had a seven-figure result for our client on each of the four cases. One was actually an eight-figure result for all the plaintiffs, but to be fair, our clients only got 7.7 something million of the 38 million allowed in that case. Brake Buchenhofer, a brilliant lawyer, also did really, really well in that case. He had a really, really hurt client. But I also don't want to take credit for Blake's work because I love the man, and that wouldn't be fair. So how about you? What are some things that you've learned?
Well, one thing that you touched on, I think you're right. AI is incredibly useful. So we did a couple at our firm. As you know, we had an AI committee that kind of scoured and found some AI products that are better than others. And I have to tell you that I walked in at the beginning of the year highly, highly suspicious of AI, highly, highly resistant of the whole process, because I thought there's no way that any computer is going to be able to lawyer as good as I can. And I think that's still true. But it does make things so much easier when it's processing information. And so for those AI tools that do allow you to upload specific documents and data, creating chronologies and finding consistencies in the data or in the testimony, it's been a real game changer for my practice just in the last 6 months.
It was huge in my last trial. My last trial, and as usual, I mean, Mallory did a great job of working it up, but I'm parachuting in within 30 days of trial. And there were over 40,000 pages of medical records, more than 10,000 pre-injury, because our client had some issues going on before she got hurt, and then at least 30,000 pages of post-injury medical records. And where it really helped me is when the defense was trying to say that all these things are pre-existing, I was able to just ask the AI program we chose and say, when was the last time the client had back pain? When was the last time the client had this? Was the client independent in her activities of daily living before? And it would give me the date, but it would also give me the page. And I just click a link, and I could get right there. And, oh, my gosh, it made cross-examination so easy because I was really able to show how the defense was cherry-picking, taking things out of context, leaving out the fact like my client had not been to the doctor for back pain for 3 years before the crash and then constant back pain since. So those kind of things I think were really good. Another really kind of neat use case, when I had this really, really big death case in New Mexico that, you know, we got a really nice recovery on, but we're going to test it. And I wanted to make sure that we're giving the defense, you know, equal time. In other words, when we're testing it, we need to test a strong defense case as well as a strong plaintiff's case. And so I did my very best to write out the defense arguments. But then I took some of the depositions and the defense expert report, it's an expert disclosure, and put them into, and the police report, put them into three different AI models and just said, you're an insurance defense lawyer. You want to come up with all the defenses you can, including but not limited to these, and you want to do them in a way that's not going to, word them in a way that will not offend a jury. And it came up with some things I hadn't thought of myself. Now that one, I wanted to blend the human and the AI. So actually on that one, it was a big case, I could afford to do it. I actually hired a former insurance defense lawyer then to go revise it and make sure we had the human part on too. But the AI was really helpful in coming up with ideas of things that I might have missed.
And this was for your focus group?
It was for the big data study we did. And
I see.
And that way we could really be sure. So like when I showed it to the mediator, I'm like, Judge, this is look, are there any points that we made in here that the defense is making that are not in here?
I think that's an excellent use, Michael, because when you're crafting what we think is going to be the defense argument, we can't help have our own bias, right?
Yeah.
Bias in favor of our client or our case. So, I mean, I think that's clever.
And when we're offended by their arguments, we have trouble writing them away. Like they're saying, like, you know, the death isn't worth as much because Our Lady had so many, you know, problems with her lifestyle, her criminal history, and that she would have died sooner. To me, that's an offensive argument. Like, oh, this person's worth nothing. You can kill her for free or you can get a discount and cheap on killing her. And because I was so offended by it, I had trouble writing it in a persuasive way for the defense, whereas AI came
had
up.
Had no problem.
Yeah, no, it did a pretty good job if you tell it, you know, what its role is and how to do it. And if you use multiple bottles, too, I think it helps. And I use the free ones for that. But then the I say free. I use the $20 a month ones that I pay. But then, you know, I think in a case that big, getting a defense lawyer actually to polish it too was helpful. But I think the AI, was good. I think it's really good for medical records. I think it's really good for finding things in depositions. Where it still needs a long way to go, I think, is legal research. You know, we recently, as part of our evaluation, picked up the Lexis AI product. And the good thing is it doesn't make up cases that don't exist, but it doesn't always get the holdings of the cases right. And so I think it's about, to me, it's about 75% accurate. It might be a little higher than yours, but always, like, it's a useful tool, but you always have to read the case to make sure the case really says it. And it does seem to want to tell you what you want to hear.
Right. And I think that's true even for our internal AI databases. They skew a little bit in favor to what I want to hear. I don't know why.
Yeah. No, they absolutely. It's like human beings. It figures out what you want. It's because it's all just, it's not really intelligent. It's just guessing what the next word should be.
I wonder if that's why your query ended up working out so well, is because you kind of started it from the premises. I am a defense lawyer, and I want to try to defend this case. And then if you start with that premise, you're probably going to get a different answer than
Because ChatGPT, there's a query I saw someone I did, you know, tell me what everything you know about me, don't hold back and stuff. And ChatGPT knows that I am a plaintiff's personal injury lawyer at Cowan Rodriguez Peacock, that I do trucking cases, that I have a wife, and I have two children, and that knows because of some travel-related things I've asked what kind of trips I like to take. it's crazy, but it knows a lot about me, and so it knows what I want to hear. And so you have to tell it, like, from the perspective of this. But then I find using Perplexity and Claude, you know, using other models as well. That way, Grok, you get different, you know, you get different perspectives. And if you just copy the same query, it doesn't take very long to run the same one in multiple AIs. So I think that, you know, it's going to keep getting better and better. I don't think it's ever going to replace human reasoning. AI will at best get you the average argument to make. It's never going to give you the brilliant one. It's never going to find that one case, that one argument, that one theory that's a new, creative, innovative one. But I think it's a nice way to find, like, the basics. And it's great also when you're just going out of state. Like, we're doing a Pennsylvania state court case right now. And I'm just like, what are the rules for comparative fault in Pennsylvania? And it gets me the rules, and I double check the statute and make sure it's right, instead of having to go do a bunch of research myself. And it is a lot easier.
It does make life a little easier. Number two on your list was focusing on your health during trial.
Yeah, you know, I did so well on my health the first half of this year. And the first trial I did, where Laura and I did the trial, I was getting up every morning and exercising and meditating, and I stayed on my no-carb diet, and I didn't drink any alcohol. Wasn't so good on the case that you and I tried later. I think a lot of that
was a bad influence.
I don't think you were the bad influence. I think that, the judge was having us work late. She was making us redo all of our depo cuts. She was making us brief all these issues. So, you know, I was getting 3-4 hours of sleep a night. And what I found is I just don't have the discipline to be healthy, exercise, and work 20-hour days. I would like to get there one day. I don't have it yet. And then this last trial, it's something similar. I mean, I worked constantly. It was a 2.5-week trial. It's very contentious. And I think I only got up and walked twice during the whole trial.
Wow.
And I was back in my hometown of Brownsville, where the Mexican food is so good. It's so much more tempting there than it is here. And I was eating all my old favorite things. And as a result, you know, my pants are a lot tighter now than they were in June. So one of my big goals that I'll talk about for 26 is that balancing, doing a better job like I did that first trial of balancing how you take care of yourself. And I do say that I'm proud of my work in this trial, but there are probably one or two times when my tone was not, when I'm impeaching somebody, and my tone maybe was a little harsher than, like Mallory said, hey, the jury didn't like it when you talked to her this way, when I'm cross-examining somebody. And even though I thought it was deserved, but at the same time, I'm better than that. And I think the lack of sleep, the lack of clarity, the eating bad, I think that does not help as far as your ability to stay focused and kind and loving when you're cross-examining people.
Well, you had, we had a big talk at the Big Rig Boot Camp this year on mindset. And
yeah.
I thought it was a pretty powerful conversation about it being a you know, roller coaster ride. Some days are good and some days are bad. And do you think it's just, you know, maybe the number of trials back to back this year didn't help?
Oh, no, I want more. Because I had a blast. And I do want to say that I was having fun. I was not feeling stressed during this last trial. It was 2.5 weeks. I was having a good time throughout the trial. The reason I wasn't sleeping is that my mind just wouldn't stop going. I kept coming up with more and more ideas, kept, you know, looking things up, you know, and waking up, getting in the eye and going through the medical records again. So I think part of it was just I was really into it. But I do think that if I had slept 8 hours a night and gotten up and exercised, yes, I still would. I was still having fun, but I think I would have been a little bit more present and a little more relaxed while I was having fun. But no, I wanted, you know, 2 to 4 is my magic number. We did 3. That was just right. And, you know, I want to do 3 or 4 again next year. It's way too much fun to not do more.
And I think we have a bunch of cases in the hopper ready to go. So that's good.
Yep. As much as I'd like to settle them, I would love to try a few of them too.
Well, you also listed as one of the things that you learned this year about major changes in the industry. What do we need to be worried about?
Well,
or what opportunities are there?
Yeah, I think the for us, you know, we're a referral-based practice, and I think the business of plaintiff's law is consolidating. I think you're getting more and more big firms with huge advertising, and now that people can get private equity money by using a vehicle through Arizona and having, you know, there's all sorts of ethical issues because, like, Texas lawyers aren't supposed to share fees with a firm that has a non-lawyer owner, but things are going to happen. And so I see, like, the bigger firms getting more and more of the cases and having marketing budgets that are really hard for the people in the middle to compete with. And I see the people in the middle, a lot of them are going to work for the big firms because a lot of the bigger firms now, instead of referring out their litigation like they've done historically, they're hiring litigators, the people in the middle that used to get enough cases coming in that now that the big firms are, you know, dominating digital, dominating broadcast, dominating every aspect of it, even going and sending people with donuts to the body shop, asking them to recommend people. You know, it's getting harder. I think it's getting harder and harder. So I think that the necessity, if you want to grow and get above a certain size, to market yourself directly to the public, to have a tribe of people that want to send you cases, is more important than ever. And for that reason, I mean, we're definitely keeping up our strong referral practice, and we value our referral partners, and we want to grow and have more. You know, we are adding a direct-to-consumer marketing component to our practice because I just see the changes in the industry, and I love having a bigger firm. I don't want to get small, and I think to do that, we have to change the way we market ourselves. But I think that's something we all have to look at. And even within the big firms, a lot of them are going from having their lawyers as employees to having them 1099 contractors and, you know, eat what you kill. And, you know, I don't think that's a good model. I don't think that's good for clients. I don't think it's good for lawyers, but I see more and more of it. And I think part of it is because the advertising costs are so high that they're really trying to cut their overhead because it's just this – everyone's spending crazy amounts of money marketing. And I think people are still marketing on things that don't work as well, like TV, where you're spending more and more money for fewer and fewer eyeballs. And I just think this consolidation and this huge increase in marketing budgets and then this – the bigger firms not referring out but keeping their own litigation – is something that's a trend in the industry that we have to keep, you know, keep our eyes open about and make sure that we find a way to get enough good work to keep us happy.
What does that mean, Michael, for the solo practitioners or the folks out there who are listening and have, you know, one or two lawyers in their offices and you know, relatively small docket?
It means you need to find a way that there's a group of people where you are their go-to person and you keep them very happy. Whether that's a group of people, it could be people in your church, your former clients and their zones of influences. It could be you've got a couple firms that will refer to you and you hope that they keep referring to you and they don't bring it in house. But, you know, keep your, you definitely need to go and market yourself to non-lawyers more than ever, because even if you have like a really good source of business, the danger that that lawyer will see, hey, I can go hire another lawyer, add them of counsel, not pay a salary, and then not refer my cases out anymore and keep more of the fee. Even if you do a better job than that other lawyer they might hire, it is very tempting for them to try to do that. And that I just see that happening more and more. Now, we still get enough referrals in to keep 10 lawyers busy. So it's not like it's totally changed, but it's a trend I see. You know, that trend continues. You know, you need to be ready for it. It's not something that's going to happen overnight, but it is something I've seen changing over the last 2 or 3 years.
But it is good advice, you know, for those listeners out there who have smaller practices, 2 or 3 lawyers, 1, 2, 3 lawyers. I mean, the reality is, if this is changing, what they can do now is, you know, make their community connections solid.
Yep.
And grow them.
And the one thing that's hardest for me, for some reason, I don't know why, because I have no problem asking lawyers for cases, but you have to let people know, this is what I do, and I would love it if you or someone else you know needs me. I'd love to help them.
You know, I don't know why. I think that's true for a lot of us. If you're sitting at your kid's, you know, basketball game and sitting next to another parent, you're not exactly going to say, hey, if you or anyone you know is injured in a, you know, tractor-trailer crash, let me know. But it's something I think we do need to focus on moving forward.
Absolutely.
One of the other things that you listed as something that you learned this year had to do with clarity in communicating with teams. Were you talking about working with our staff, paralegals? What teams are you talking about?
With everybody, with staff, with paralegals, with experts, with the clients. You know, Michael Mogul at Crisp has a saying, and he may have gotten it from someone else, but clarity is kindness. And, you know, I used to worry, and I still do, so much about hurting people's feelings that when I talk to them, I'm like, I'm not saying you're doing a bad job, but you could consider doing this, and this would be a little better. And they don't necessarily get the message of what I'm trying to send them. It's much better to say, our standard at this firm is we contact the client at least once every 30 days. You didn't do it. You need to figure out why and fix it. And, you know, just be very clear about it. It's just not that I don't like you. It's just, this is our standard. This is how we do things, and this is what you are to do. And just... same for experts. Like, I am paying you money. I need a draft report by this date. I don't care when the court says I have to turn in the report. If you want to work for me, I need to have a report for you by this date. We can get along great, but for us to get along great, this is my line in the sand. And then draw those lines and enforce them. Like, hey, I'm not hiring you in the next case because you didn't get me the report on time.
And sometimes that can be viewed as difficult or, you know, unreasonable or obtuse, but...
but I don't care.
It needs to happen.
Because, look, if you don't tell them that, then you still get all mad at them, and you still don't hire them in the next case, and they don't know why. And it's much better just to tell them, like, now I've got 3 other cases with you. If you get the report in on time next time, you'll get back on the list. But as long as you get me that report late, you're off the list. I even tell that to salespeople. Like, I don't know how you got my cell phone number, but I have a rule. If someone calls me once unsolicited, I will not do business with their company for a year. If you call me twice, I will never do business with your company.
Do you think that's harder to do, that kind of approach to communication is harder to do with people that you work with every day, like your paralegals and your, you know, file room people?
Yes, it's hardest with the people I like. It's hardest with you and Mallory. It is the more I care about the person, the harder it is for me to be super clear about, like, when we need to improve something, when something's not working as well as it could, especially when things are going, like, pretty well, but they could be doing better. But you don't want to hurt someone's feelings, and you care about them, and you don't want them to quit, and you don't want them to not like you. But I've just been learning, like, the more I can just be clear, and this, I have to teach other people that assume good intent with me, and I'll prove it. Like, you may be mad. You may not assume good intent the first time I tell you. But then when you realize I'm not saying it to set you up, I'm not saying it to put you down, I'm trying to make us both better, that over time I will earn that trust and it will be viewed as kindness, that I'm actually saying what I think instead of letting things fester. And I don't know how many partnership breakups and ugly lawyer exits I've had where I think part of the root cause was my lack of clarity and letting things fester for too long till I couldn't just stand them anymore.
And then they just explode, you know. Yeah.
Now, it may have been that the relationship wouldn't have worked anyway, but if I had really clearly defined expectations from the beginning, then that person could just say, well, I don't want to do that. Maybe this isn't the place for me. We can leave as friends instead of waiting till it's so far gone that it gets ugly.
Right. And I think you made a good point about always assuming good intent. I think if that's the fundamental framework of the relationship, you're going to assume good intent, even if somebody's saying something that you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, important part of a partnership, a friendship, a marriage.
Yeah.
So that's important.
Yeah, and it really, I was, like, really proud of Mallory in the trial. Like, she's like, you did this well. You did this. You need to make up for this. You didn't do this clearly enough. You know, a juror made a face when you did this. Don't do it again. You know, just the way that she's able, knowing that I'm going to assume that's good intent from her. She's not worried about hurting my feelings because she didn't do it in a mean way. She just said, hey, I noticed when you did this yesterday, it did not go over well. try to do it different tomorrow. And I said, thank you, because I took it as good intent. You're trying to make us both better. Probably most people I try a case with would not tell me that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I'll be honest, like, I saw another lawyer send a message to somebody after trial telling them what a good job they did. And it made me question every nice thing that lawyer ever told me, because I knew privately the lawyer didn't believe that.
Well, I think in this practice, we're all pretty tough skinned. I mean,
yeah.
I would hope that among friends and colleagues and people who are genuinely trying to make each other better, we don't have to just blow smoke up each other's asses.
You know, that's not been my experience historically, but it is at this firm. But I think it's because we've made the commitment, one, to tell each other we're going to assume good intent, but to try to give better clarity. And then people still, the first few times they do it, they still get hurt. They still misinterpret it. But then the world doesn't end. And then over it's something that you have to do over time and develop, like any other relationship. It just can't be like starting today, we're going to have a totally different relationship. It's like starting today, we're going to start working on it, and we're going to have to work through the feelings and the emotions. Because, you know, I'll be honest, if 10 years ago I was in the middle of trial and Mallory said, well, hey, I may not have taken it as well. I may have been more defensive. I may have been like, who are you to tell me this? You know, but now
that's true, too. We, even in our management of the firm, you know, when I first joined the firm, I think we had one of our very first management meetings, and it was, I wouldn't say contentious, but it was a lively discussion. And yeah. I remember texting you afterwards saying, hey, I'm really sorry about the way that all came down. And you said, I'm assuming you want this firm to be better. So thank you for pointing these things out.
Yeah.
And so I think that changed, you know, the tenor of our relationship. But I think clarity is important. If it's coming from a good place.
Yeah. If it's coming from a good place. I mean, if you're putting someone down just to put them down.
Or being critical.
Like, let's say Mallory said, you know, Michael, you've gained some weight, and I don't think the jury likes you as much. Or, you know, if you were better looking, or, you know, if you had a different eye color, or you had a different, you know, maybe you should get a facelift or something. You know, that's not helpful. You know, whether it's true or not, it's not helpful. But it wasn't that. It's like, hey, your tone of voice slipped a little bit here. You know, try to work on that tomorrow. You need to be more clear about this one thing. I don't think people got it. On redirect, make sure you clarify this point. You know, that was helpful and actionable and appreciated. And it's one of the reasons I love her so much, and I love trying cases with her. So
she's very intuitive too.
Yeah, she is. And I'm not. I mean, we all have our strengths. So.
So one of the other things that you talked about was consistency. What did you mean by that? That you learned to be consistent?
Yeah, you know, I am not a naturally consistent person. My whole life has been working in spurts. You know, trying to come up with one big idea, getting one big inspiration, and I've learned, well, that is valuable to have big ideas and to be inspired by things. If you actually want to get anything done, you have to work at it every day, or at least every week, and be consistent with it, and set a rhythm, and have that discipline, and do it whether you feel like it or not.
But how? How have you been able to do that? I mean, that's a really hard thing to do. It's like some people are wired to not be the types of folks that can do, you know, can maintain a consistency.
You know, honestly, a lot of it's just self-talk. A lot of it's just like, if I expect this out of other people, I need to do it myself. This is where I need to get better. If I want to achieve this result, this is what I have to do. I need to stick with it. I journal every morning, or almost every morning. It needs to be every morning, speaking of consistency. And I'm not perfect at it, but I've learned that, like, the more consistent I am at getting things done, whether I feel like them or not, the more things I get that I achieve.
Are there any tools that you use to help you with your consistency?
There is. I mean, public accountability. Like, when I tell other people I'm going to do something, and this is how you can tell whether I'm doing it or not. You know, I have an assistant, and I give her permission to hold me accountable. And to bring up when I'm not doing anything and remind me that I promised that I would do this. But like, you know, we came out of trial, and then I had to do what's called an attorney development meeting, because it's important that I meet with every lawyer every month to go over things. And I didn't feel like I did one this morning, I'm doing another one this afternoon. I don't feel like doing them. I feel like taking the day off, but I need to get this podcast episode recorded. I need to have these meetings with lawyers, because we need to communicate and we need to keep our cases moving forward. And whether I am tired today and want a nap doesn't matter, because this needs to get done, and it's more important to me I'm willing to have the short-term pain of pushing myself through the day in order to have the long-term gain of, you know, keeping my our dockets functioning, keeping this podcast going.
It's hard to fall off of that, you know, consistency path if you put things on your calendar and you're meeting with people. Because then you have somebody that you're disappointing or somebody that you're canceling on. I think that is helpful, making sure that you have some path towards like what you're doing too with these attorney development meetings. You schedule them way out in advance.
We do. And when we have trials coming up, I try to get trial team meetings set. And it's as much for me as everyone else on the team, because I know if I'm asking them to do things and I have to do my part on time. Because my natural thing is to wait till the last minute and do it all and stay up all night and, you know, do good enough. But that's not the best way to get the best result. And that's also a way to panic everyone else on my team. And so I've learned, like, if I set these meetings and then I publicly say, I'm going to do these things by these dates. And when we're going through what everyone else is supposed to do, I also go through what I'm supposed to do. And right, I think that public accountability helps.
I think that's a valuable tool. I mean, using your calendar and creating calendar invitations with people to hold you accountable for those meetings is one way.
But I think everyone needs, you know, whether it's a coach, a coworker, everybody needs an accountability partner.
And the number six item on your year in review was it's a good time to try cases, even in conservative venues. Tell us why you think so.
Because people, not just at our firm, but at a lot of other firms, are getting really good results. There's something in the national mood that if you have a case with good liability and decent damages, people are getting much better verdicts than they were 5-10 years ago. The first time we tried four cases, one resolved for multiple seven figures during trial. The other three were all seven-figure results, and you know, two of those three were high seven-figure results. And I've never had four seven-figure results in a trial in 1 year before. And no sub seven figure results at trial this year. Sooner or later I'll have them, but right now we haven't. And you know, other, you know, Michael Lieserman's trial where he got $82 million in a quote unquote conservative venue. And I just talked to lawyer after lawyer after lawyer where they're trying cases in venues where people say, oh, no one will give you any money in this venue. And people are getting incredible results in those venues. And so I just think this is a really good time to try cases. I cannot tell you what it is. But there is no longer this Republican versus Democrat divide on our issues. You even see it like in the legal stuff. You know, on this, there's a big issue in trucking law about preemption of cases against brokers. And the United States Supreme Court on the Montgomery cases granted cert. They've taken it up. And the attorney generals for 29 states plus D.C. filed a brief supporting the plaintiff side. So you not only do you have like the California and New Mexico Attorney General that you would expect to support the plaintiffs, but Texas, Ohio, all of these very conservative jurisdictions also are saying we need tort liability. Our attorney generals are elected. Republican attorney generals are saying that. It's the going from country club Republicans to MAGA Republicans. The landscape is changing. And right now, you know, things go in waves. But right now the pendulum has swung our direction. And, you know, it's a good time to try a good case.
Well, for those folks out there who are starting their law practices or PI practices and or have relatively small firms that are divided with pre-lit and litigation, what things can they do now? What advice do we have for them to take advantage of this landscape, that it's a great time to try cases?
Well, there's one of two things. One, you know, can you get your practice to stop long enough? Now, in other words, you get stuff done in advance. Because to try a case, you need to have 100% focus on that trial during the time of trial. So you either need to arrange things where you can do that, where, you know, clients can leave messages, you can, you know, catch up, get ahead on your work, and then catch up afterwards. And that's what I used to do. It was stressful, but it's what I used to do. Or you get a trial partner and, you know, try it with someone else, split the fee, and that way you have someone that can be entirely focused and you could be in trial. But let them take the initial focus. You're learning what you're doing, but then you can go back and return those client calls and do the other things you have to do to keep the doors open while you're waiting for the trial to get done. They're both valid. I've done it both ways. I mean, when I was a young lawyer, I was trying a lot of cases on my own. It was fun, but it was really, really stressful because then everything piles up and you got to get back. We had different plaintiffs in the same case, but I tried a case with other lawyers from other firms. And there are some frustrations because you do things differently, but I made a really good friend, a guy named Blake Ruckenhofer, brilliant lawyer. I really loved the experience of trying the case with him. And that was a lot of fun. So, and just like I get to try cases with you, Mallory, Laura, Natalie, I mean, in our office, trying cases with other people, honestly, is a lot more fun than trying them on your own. And it's not as hard. I mean, you have other people to split the work with.
I mean, you bring up a good point. If we're going to be out at the courthouse trying cases, somebody's got to be back at the office manning the fort. And, those are things that you've got to put in place if you're going to, at a smaller firm, take advantage of this opportunity in the changing landscape. What we're seeing is that it's a great time to try cases. There's also some financial things that come into play. You've got to be ready. Talk a little bit about, the financial realities of trying a case.
Well, it depends on the case. When you're trying soft tissue cases, they don't cost a whole lot of money. Although I still believe you should always have some medical professional testify, even if it's just by video in every case. And that's going to cost you something normally. But, yeah, to try a big case, I mean, it's hard to do it for, less than six figures. I mean, you want to have experts, but you want to have good experts. You need to show things visually. Most people are visual thinkers, so you need to create, graphical ways to show things, whether it's medical illustrations, timelines, a lot of other kind of posters and visual aids we use at our firm. It does take a financial commitment to do that. And even if you win the trial, you're probably going to have an appeal if you win big enough. And so you need to be able to withstand that storm, either have enough money saved up or have good enough financing where you could put the money in and wait it out. But I do recommend it, though. It's a lot of fun. And, even when you don't win the trial, the fact that you try cases increases the value of all your other cases, because the insurance companies know that most people take the last offer at the last minute. And that's why offers go up so much during trial. And that's why when you try cases, you get such better offers.
And there's no better feeling than going to the courthouse when you know that the offer that was made to your client is not acceptable. I mean, you sleep good. Your client sleeps good and knows that you're fighting for them. So that's a good feeling.
Sonia, I've loved practicing with you in 2025. We've had a good year. I think we've done a lot of good things, but we've also learned how we could do some things better. And I hope everyone listening has had a good 2025. And I look forward to 2026 and wish everyone great health and success in the new year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you'd like to receive updates, insider information, and more from Trial Lawyer Nation, sign up for our mailing list at triallawyernation.com. You can also visit our episodes page on the website for show notes and direct links to any resources in this or any past episode. To help more attorneys find our podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast on any of our social media outlets. If you'd like access to exclusive plaintiff lawyer-only content and live monthly discussions with me, send a request to join the Trial Lawyer Nation Insider Circle Facebook group. Thanks again for tuning in. I look forward to having you with us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us by calling 210-941-1301 to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. This podcast has been hosted by Michael Cowan and is not intended to, nor does it create, the attorney-client privilege between our host, guest, and any listener for any reason. Content from the podcast is not to be interpreted as legal advice. All thoughts and opinions expressed herein are only those from which they came.